Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK small cap fund manager Lawrence Halls of Onward Opportunities. So welcome, Laurie.
Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Paul. Thanks for having us back on the ever enjoyable Vox Markets podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. But yeah, big congrats on today's strong first half results. And I did notice since inception, about 2.5 years ago, the company or the fund has beaten its index by about 35%. So big hat tip to that. Maybe we can start there. What's the sort of secret sauce behind the really very strong returns?
Well, I think like all investors, we felt like we've been sailing into the wind. And whilst the fund's up sort of 35% since launch, you know, the comparator indices have been really tough because the world's been pretty tough for all of us. And therefore, our returns have come from being slightly contrarian. We tend to buy things that are priced even worse than the rest of the market, but also crucially where we see the potential, the catalyst for change that can hopefully change that low pricing as well. I talked about in our results this morning, competition for capital is fiercer than ever. You've got some really fast growing, you know, Mag 7 stocks in America. You've got governments offering you a meaningful risk-free rate for the first time ever. So if you're small cap XYZ in the UK, you've got to really be pitching for people's money harder than ever. There's crypto in the mix as well. And we do see that as a bit of, it's been a bit of a structural challenge the past few years. So it's been the stocks where they've done something to command value, command capital, where we've really captured some of those returns. And I'm sure we'll talk about a few of those today.
Yeah, just one of those headwinds in terms of particularly the small cap sector. We've had, obviously, over the last 10 years, unfortunately, a big move into passives. And the active fund managers, both large and small cap, have struggled a bit. When do you think that's going to change? Because it still seems as though there's outflows at the sort of the fund manager level.
There definitely is. I think sort of partly understandably so. Active management has been, you know, underperforming, not really justifying its existence at times. Now, the passive argument is a curious one because obviously it is a slightly false economy. If everyone went into passive, it just wouldn't work. And it does, you do require that active management, that price discovery, the sort of things we've been doing to make a market. I think sadly though, whilst focus remains on costs rather than outcomes, and whilst there is this still its ability to have a bit of a free rider effect because there is still enough active management out there to create a market for passive to exist, it will continue, I think, until there's some sort of kind of blow up in the past. You've had Too Big to Fail with banks. You've had, you know, Woodford and REITs gating their funds, and then that led to change. I think with passive, we'll get one day to a level where, you know, the passive machines or algorithms turn sellers than buyers, and they realize that you can't all passively get out at the same time.
Yeah.
And that will sort of shatter the illusion a little bit. And until then, it will remain a headwind.
Yeah. And what's your sort of like outlook for small caps then over the next 12 months, given we've obviously got these headwinds in 2025?
I'm going to focus on the UK because that's our sort of stomping ground, and there's nothing worse than people who speak when they've actually got nothing to say. So I'm not going to comment on the US or anything like that. But I think in the UK, unfortunately, we're pretty bearish. Anyone can get subjective about policies and politicians, and you know, there are numerous ways to try and run a company and an economy. But where we really get cross is things like picking a date for a budget. which is an objective decision. You can believe what you like about what policy to put in, but it's a date and a time. I can't think of a worse day than the 26th of November for three reasons. It's a repeat of last year, but you know, you're maximizing this sort of lag time, this air pocket of uncertainty. Even an A-level economics student will tell you uncertainty is not good for business and decision-making. A thing in the mix this year versus last year is the Chancellor is also going to be playing chicken with the bond market because they are now on her back. You've seen that in this move in yield prices through the course of the year. If you inverted it, it wouldn't be the chart of yields at the moment, then probably not a stock you would be stepping in to buy. It looks like there's further upside to come. You know, 12 weeks of that, that's pretty brave if you ask me, because the bond market will start speculating until the budget comes out. And then finally, I don't know about you, I tend to do my Christmas shopping early December. I'm pretty organized and don't want the kind of Love Actually style rush at the end. But yeah, you're going to be likely slapping consumers with a load of negativity and taking money out of their pockets right before a key consumer spending period. I do slightly tear my hair out. So unfortunately, we're not hugely sort of bullish on the market structurally, certainly till that's out of the way. But of course, as we're demonstrating with our own performance, and you know, many of the listeners would have had loads of winners this year where there have been some stocks that have really performed, it creates opportunity, it creates value dislocations to capitalize on. And investors have got to look through the near-term noise, the macro, not try and time the market too much, and find these gems amongst the rubble. And that is what we call it at Onward. The market is slightly in pieces, blown apart in the UK for a series of different sort of themes and drivers. But if you prepare to rummage amongst the sort of broken bricks, you can really find some gems. And we had a couple last year for the listeners, and hopefully we'll talk about a few more today.
Yeah. No, I'm a bit more positive, a bit more half glass full, actually, on the budget. I'm hoping the reason for the sort of like the 12-month lag is because Angela Rayner has now stepped away. She's obviously the main sort of supporter for the hard left of the Labour Party. And it gives effectively Starmer and Reeves now a chance to actually that extra 12 weeks to actually get all their ducks in one row in terms of being able to do welfare cuts into that budget. And if they can actually marry welfare cuts into this budget and balance the bond market with a few sort of like, you know, not too aggressive tax increases, then actually we could get a decent result. So that's the only reason why I'm semi-hopeful that there is some reasoning in this madness of delaying the budget announcement until the 26th of November. But I could be just be a hopeful idiot, as usual.
I hope you're right and I'm wrong.
Okay. Anybody wants to ask Laurie any questions, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. Let's start from the right from the top. We've got Varun Kapoor. He's asking about React, which is basically a contract cleaning business. And I think also bought a drainage business quite recently, probably struggling a bit with the input costs of NI and wage inflation, I think. But what's your latest view on React?
I think if any listeners pull off our interim report and accounts that came out this morning, if you go onto the Onward website or something like Investigate, it was RNS.
Yeah.
You'll see we provide quite a detailed synopsis of our key investments. React is one of the top 10, so gets that sort of treatment and coverage. And, you know, it's quite clear it's one we're frustrated with at the moment in the portfolio. The frustration is because there is a lot of potential here. The clues in the name, React, the business originated in, and things like the Aquaflow business you referenced, the unblocking of the drains, they have some pricing power, some pricing elasticity, because if you're pipe is blocked and it's flooding, or in the case of the original React business, if you need something cleaning urgently, like a set of railway tracks, it's almost a case of get here now and I'll sort of pay whatever it costs. I think where the business has misstepped is the Ladders Free acquisition, which was popular at the time because of its working capital model. You know, window cleaning, even if it's without a ladder, is still slightly discretionary. And I think where they've been suffering is people have just toned down the cadence of how often they get the window cleaned, because they can still get by without that, unlike, say, a blocked pipe or a flood. And, you know, we are slightly frustrated because some of these things we've spotted and are pushing the company to sort of refocus on and almost get back to the core secret sauce. Mm. And as an active and engaged shareholder ourselves, and you know, the register is quite well populated for a company of its size, you can expect lots of that sort of engagement and encouragement going on behind the scenes. But you know, one today, not where we hoped it would be, but it's trading on, I think, three times EBITDA at the moment. So it's sort of priced accordingly and potential from here.
Yeah. Good. Okay, let's move to another one. We've got Ben Sharman. He's asking about Springfield Properties, which is a Scottish house builder, and I think they've built a big packet of land, I think, in sort of central North Scotland to benefit from renewables, and they just sold some land, didn't they, to Darratt's. But anyway, what's your take? Because there is a lot of headwinds in UK house building with interest rates at the moment.
There certainly is across the UK a headwind in house building, and that'll probably be a theme as we talk through today. Things like stamp duty are proving very unhelpful across the UK, especially in the southeast. Now, Scotland is Springfield is based in Scotland, where housing affordability and prices are much lower. But in the case of Springfield, it's almost a land bank with a house building business on the side for us. You're right to flag the company's been making a series of profitable disposals since those difficulties in 2023, where the share price came down a lot and we started getting involved. What is really exciting is what can come next on that sort of strategic turnaround, where the company has disclosed that a lot of this land, they've sold off a lot of the land in the sort of borderlands and mid Scotland, but the remaining sort of bulk of the asset portfolio is based in the Highlands, really up near Inverness, around the Scottish Freeports and the Green Power Line, both of which, if keener listeners fancy a day or two out of away from their desk, to go up and look, the scale of it is ginormous. And there just simply is not enough accommodation to house the construction workers required to build these massive infrastructure sites. And therefore, Springfield, as the main landowner and property developer in the region, is very well placed to capitalize on this. We actually expect sort of supernormal profits from almost an ability to build and rent out homes at hotel type prices to the likes of Scottish Southern Energy, and perhaps even formalize that in some kind of strategic arrangement, because SSE will want something in return for giving that amount of work to Springfield. So it's definitely all eyes on the business and the developments up in that part of the world.
Just on that one, Laurie, just on that one, with the that mid-Scotland, they're basically doing build-to-rent, are they? Because, I mean, effectively, if you've got workers and they're temporary, like 2 or 3 year project work for renewables, then they're basically building for somebody else, basically, to rent them out.
That sort of work. But, of course, Scottish Southern and all the construction, I mean, we suspect they'll be there for nearer to 10 years than 2 to 3, given the scale of the works required in this country's propensity for things to overrun. But once they're done, you know, Scottish Southern won't need to rent those properties anymore. But of course, the new workers for the ports and the local economy, which is going to massive rejuvenation, will. So you might get one of these quite attractive build-to-rent type scenarios, but then Springfield left at the end the opportunity to keep letting those properties out to the local workforce.
Okay, good. And just totally in terms of the, you know, the budget coming up, house builders, you're not anticipating anything negative coming through from Rachel Reeves in terms of another windfall property tax or anything like that?
Look, I think there's sadly plenty coming down the road in the foot. There's some speculation around, or I think planned increases in landfill tax for house builders. I think you had a Nick and Christopher Mills on here not long ago, yeah, running through a real kind of cascade of costs and headwinds.
Yeah,
going house builders' way. On the flip side, I think there's a small chance they try and do something about stamp duty, which, if you talk to anyone in the sort of value chain of the property market, from sort of estate agents all the way back to brick makers, the market is clearly seized up on what has become a very large transaction tax, disproportionately weighted to the London and the South East, which is where property prices are higher, and therefore these new bans kick in more aggressively. Why would you move home if you're going to be incurring a 12-15% marginal tax rate for the pleasure? And we are still an economy very much geared to property price valuations as people's main asset, and I think you are seeing now this feeding through to weakness in property prices in London and the South East. But also, how much work is based on people moving? You go through AIM or the small cap market, whether it's someone like a Topps Tiles or a Likewise or a Evolution, these property transactions trigger people to redo the bathroom or the kitchen or the garden. It's everywhere, and it feels like a bit of a false economy to be really seizing up the property market. And that's the sort of description we hear from, we had Michelmersh, the brick company, in last week, who are having a really tough time of it. Good business, good margins historically, good young management team. There's nothing you can do if the big property developers have stopped being able to sell apartment plots off plan. So they're just not putting spades in the ground. So they're not buying any bricks. And it sounded like a real seize up. And I think there was even some data over the weekend backing up what they said. New housing starts now are back to where they were in 2012, when we were still coming out of the sort of post global financial crisis malaise. I saw Angela Rayner described as a sort of force of nature over the weekend. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought she was the housing minister. So the natural forces must have been blowing elsewhere, because they're certainly not blowing in the property market at the moment.
Yeah, no, I know. No, I mean, they're right. The stamp duty is such a big sort of like a friction cost that people have to bear to then buy a house, and you get that multiplier effect from property. Okay, we've got a follow-up from Ben Sharma. He's asking about the company that actually done really well, the idiosyncratic risk here, Venture Life, the personal healthcare products firm. And they did a sort of like a really big disposal earlier this year, I think, which sold off their manufacturing facilities. So what was your view on Venture Life going forward? The shares have almost doubled since the start of the year.
Yeah, it's been a good performer in the Onward Nursery, the smaller part of the portfolio, where we sort of often take slightly more speculative type positions in the portfolio. And this has turned out to be a successful one of those, having really built the position 35 to 40p early in the year. What we'd spotted was really a portfolio of care, personal care brands trading on 3 or so times EBITDA. It's well documented that often transactions for personal care brands with good margins like this trade nearer 10. And actually, I think the management team, the board, have gone to highlight that with the disposal up at sort of 6-7 times. And that was for a more manufacturing-led part of the business. I think they got about $64 million in cash for it, and that's not far off what the market cap of Venture Life Group was around then, I believe, or is now. So a good example flagged by Ben of why a portfolio has been able to do well in this tough market we talk about is, if you sell a portion of your assets at a premium to the multiple you're trading on as a group, it fundamentally highlights value and should command some sort of upside. I suspect, in a kind of rip-roaring small cap bull market, this might have gone up to near a 9-10 times EBITDA, which would have been about 90 pence per share. But we're really pleased so far with the progress from 40 to 60. It does give the company some questions, because they're going to have a lot of surplus cash. And whilst the shares have had a good move, the brands they retain are still on at only about 5.5-6 times, and so still at a discount to the market. Now, the management team have communicated an interest in using the capital raised from these transactions to go and buy other brands. We're slightly wary of that, if I'm honest, Paul. Why buy something you don't know on 10 times when you can buy yourself that arguably you know better than anything on 6? And ultimately, this is shareholders' capital, not the company. If they perhaps want to go and buy some other brands down the line, come back to us with a deal, with a plan, and we can, on an informed basis, decide to back it and give it capital or not. But I think, given the size of the disposal here, you know, shareholders should see some of that back, and that is something we've actively and directly communicated to the business.
Yeah, something like a tender offer or something like that.
Tender, buyback, as long as shareholders get the chance or the choice, relatively flexible. What we wouldn't be in favour of is some sort of special dividend, because, you know, one, this is a share that has a good retail investor base. It's not very tax efficient for the individual investor, a dividend. I also think they get slightly lost in the noise. You don't get the benefit of a kind of yield valuation marker point that an ordinary recurring dividend might give you. And as I say, it's not always as tax efficient. This is one where I think a tender or a buyback could go down well.
Okay, good. All right, well, let's move a bit more technology and software. We've got Brian. He's asking about Celebrus Technologies, which is basically a specialist, I think, in sort of data management in and also sort of tracking individuals on the internet to help marketing companies through this whole thing of, you know, cookies disappear, not now currently being allowed, and also preventing online fraud. It's been through a bit of an accounting change of late, moving from perpetual licenses to ongoing recurring revenue streams. Shares have been a bit weak. How do you see this one going forward?
It's often fascinating, some of the backstory many of these AIM and smaller companies have. And believe it or not, Celebrus Technology was originally the software that caught the shoe bomber back on Boxing Day.
Was it? Wow.
Yeah, and it's that same technology now that's being sort of monetized and formed into a, you know, not insignificant business that is starting to, we think, grow again. The nuts and bolts of the business is using live first party data from a consumer's behavior on a website or on their tablet or smartphone to provide sort of behavioral analytics, originally as a sort of fraud prevention mechanism, perhaps working out if it's the person looking at the screen the same way as they did before, or perhaps touching and tapping the touch screen how they usually do in a different way to flag potential fraud risk. And latterly now, that sort of that same kind of mindset or capability set rolling out into trying to monetize for digital advertisers better. So perhaps using behavioral patterns to identify who a consumer is, what their interests are, and maximize the chances of a conversion on their sort of journey through a website or advertising campaign. And you're totally right to flag the accounting sort of changes and what I'd call really an annus horribilis. It's what we spotted earlier in the year. The company sort of, well, I think it was actually harsher than how you've described it. Not only are they switching from a perpetual license model to a SaaS model, so you get this initial drop down in revenues that then has to build back up through 2 or 3 years. And you'll see that if listeners go look at the forecasts, but also I think there'd been some slightly generous treatment of some of those revenues and how they were described, you know, some third party type sales not being completely clearly identified as such. Obviously they're not worth as much to an investor as your own homegrown sales, and then I think as well at times those numbers sort of ambiguously making their way into a kind of recurring sales number, which is obviously where the real value lies in a business like that. That was unfortunate for investors who had sort of been buying or holding this thing to 53 quid and higher, as your chart on the screen shows. For us, it did provide an opportunity to get involved right down there at sort of £1.50 recently, because at that level, from memory, the business is trading on about 1.4 times EV sales. And if the business can continue to pinch contracts off Adobe as it recently has. I think it was an RNS flagging one of those quite recently. Then this is a business that should trade on a premium to 1.4, 1.5 times sales as a proprietary software business. But I do think needs to build back up investor confidence. I think the shares seem to set a bit of a level. If I'm totally honest, we thought they might drop a little bit more. We might have been able to buy them even cheaper when the full sort of wash through of the accounting changes was announced. But what that's told us is I think probably quite a few investors have spotted what we've spotted and were there to mop up any stock, and perhaps any frustrated sellers have come out. It's in the nursery. It's not gone to full core weighting, because for us, we'd want to see, you know, ongoing validation of the thesis in the form of those ongoing contract wins. But if it can do that, you know, it's definitely massively undervalued.
Yeah. Is it going to be a beneficiary or going to be impacted by AI going forward, given all of the sort of technology that's been sort of like, you know, spent in terms of tracking individuals and stopping cybercrime and stuff?
I think, look, it's obviously the hot topic at the moment. You'd expect any technology business, especially one based in the US like Celebris is, to have fully factored that into their own product development plans. I think the cynic in me would probably say one of the early noticeable changes of AI is just humans are going to be doing less work and more time browsing websites they shouldn't, or online shopping. So perhaps, if anything, there might be a slight increased need for Celebris's offering in the near term, but let's see. Yeah, you got a good board in place now there, and yeah, some early signs of contract momentum.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move to stay in the technology sector, but more sort of hardware software combination. You've got Synetics, which is basically a specialist in CCTV surveillance. I think history came out of the offshore oil and gas and also casinos, but I remember you mentioning last time the sort of the key thesis is on sort of critical infrastructure. How do you see this one? The shares done really well, actually, done very well.
They have, although they've been spinning the wheels over the first half of this year, even though they actually upgraded numbers in the current financial year, actually earlier than they did last year, which hopefully bodes well for a November year-end business like it is. I think it probably suffered from the fact that news was released in the kind of midst of the Trump tantrum, tariff liberation day goings on. They've gone on to announce, you know, more contracts since. We think they're well set in terms of the prospects for the business. Look, it's on, I think, 10 or 11 times PE. The business is circa 2/3 software sales, which are these monitoring control software systems, proprietary software of Synetics to manage secure sites. The heritage of the business, as you say, is in casinos, where there was the highest sort of need for expensive kit like this over the years. However, the growing threats to things like energy infrastructure sites, data centers, and them being recategorized as critical infrastructure sites over the past 12 months means that this same product set has a growing addressable market, really, because the economics are starting to make sense. And you've seen them over the sort of past, really since we last spoke. I think there's been a trial one with is it Stagecoach for their fleet of coaches. 5 years ago, you wouldn't have needed a system like this to manage a fleet of coaches. They've won more contracts, I think, with the National Grid, and we hope there's more to come here. If you look at the order book they disclosed at the half year, it had grown again. The key for them now is to keep monetizing that talent they've got. They've got a cracking new chief executive in there, Amanda Lander, who's rightly conservative, I think, and kind of wants to sort of keep her head down, just keep delivering the numbers, putting the points on the board. And she's sort of tag teamed up with the highly experienced Bob Holt, who came in about 2 years ago and really kicked off the shaking of things up that's seen the share price do what it does. You know, he would describe it as a bit of a sleeping giant, and we certainly hope he's right.
Yeah. There was actually a transaction in that CCTV surveillance only last week. I think Journeo bought crime and fire protection business for about 13 million quid. And I guess the question is such that, you know, is there any synergy between those type of companies? Because obviously there's expertise and consolidation that could, if you've got a bigger business, you could get economies of scale.
I think definitely what's attractive about Synectics is it is throwing off tons of cash.
Yeah.
I think the past two or three updates, it's been ahead on cash every time. Last announced cash pile from memory was about 12.1 million on a market cap of 50 or 60. That gives them optionality for exactly that. The challenge they've got, but the opportunity for listeners, is a lot of the deals have been done on a higher valuation than Synectics is on. So it always makes you slightly nervous. But I guess if they're funding it from cash rather than issuing shares, you can get a bit more comfortable with it, especially if they're buying in synergistic capabilities like you reference, Paul. This is definitely one that is a top pick for us at the moment. It's got contract momentum. It's got IP. Most of the earnings are international, back to the sort of worries about what's going on domestically at the moment. Well, if you're, yeah, I think a key thing we spotted over the summer sort of puts into perspective things like bat caves stopping HS2 or whatever the farcical thing was earlier in this country. Marina Bay Sands, a big customer for Synectics, had a massive bond auction go through to fund a fourth tower going up at the iconic Singapore casino of theirs. Given Synectics did towers 1, 2, and 3, we'd love to think they got tower 4. It's things like that they've got the chance to go for around the world. You know, this is really one of those gems amongst the rubble. Yeah. Build world beater, on AIM, a gem amongst the rubble.
Yeah, actually, it's quite interesting. I think the CEO of Geneo, as you probably know, is the ex-CEO of Synectics.
That is correct. I think Russell's his name. Is it Russ Singleton?
Russ Singleton, yeah. So I'm sure they probably know each other pretty well. Okay, let's move into the another one which has done very well, stay in the software sector, Pebble Beach Systems, which used to be, it got spun out of Vizzling about 10, 15 years ago with a lot of debt, and now it seems to have got through that. It does play out TV software for the studios, the broadcasters historically, but now have moved more into online, sort of channel in a box, I think they sort of like marketed as. Shares have just really rocketed of late. So big tip, hat tip. How do you see this one? Quite a smaller company, though.
There's some analogy, isn't there, about pebbles starting landslides or something. And if I'm totally honest, we've slightly landed on our feet here.
Yeah.
So we spotted Pebble Beach as a bit of a cigar butt type opportunity, and for listeners not familiar with the term, it's this idea that, you know, someone's dropped away cigar butt can actually have quite a lot of value to it to someone else. And actually during the war, during rationing, people would collect cigar butts outside Whitehall and other places and sell them on. I think even I saw one of Winston Churchill's old cigar butts auctioned off for hundreds of thousands of pounds last year, but that's a rabbit hole for another day. What we'd spotted with Pebble Beach was a 35% margin business, trading at, I think when we bought the shares, at 8, 9, 7p, something like 4 or 5 times PE, absolute bargain basement. And all our screens they could do was tell us that. We then had to go and investigate why such a margin business was trading at that valuation. And the background of the business is that Pebble Beach Systems has a market-leading broadcast software where over the decades gone by, we typically consumed video media in what's called a linear fashion. So you and I, Paul, would sit the kettle on, we'd put Coronation Street on, then watch Match of the Day or whatever. And we had no choice in what order that came in. And the broadcasters had to arrange that up in a line, slot in adverts, move it around, and then when Margaret Thatcher died, they had to quickly shuffle it around again to do a BBC News special. I'm exaggerating for effect,
yeah,
but that's what they did. Obviously, broadcast media has been in structural decline for some time. That's one of the reasons why everyone sort of gave up on Pebble Beach and the shares drifted and drifted and drifted. But also to offset that, the company had tried to invest in a new product called Prima, and the circa 3 million of profit they were generating per annum on their tenner sales, they were reinvesting in Prima. So there was a little bit of cash coming off, paying off debt, but a lot of it was going back into this new product whilst we weren't investors. And we formed the view that, okay, Prima's been investing for a long time now, and we haven't seen it with any contracts. Perhaps the time has come to sort of down tools on that. I can see the logic in why they tried to do it. But why don't we just run the business you've got for cash? 3 million of profits and cash flow on a market cap of what was 10 at the time is pretty darn attractive. You only have to do that for 4 years and you've got your money back. And like all of these things, whilst I get that, or whilst we got that streaming was growing in popularity, I don't think people are going to be chucking out, fully getting rid of, the traditional TV guide within the next 4 years. And so it's proven to be, but much quicker than we realized. So what started to happen with Pebble Beach, which is quite exciting and has dramatically improved the prospects for the investment case from what was originally, return a 20% divvy yield per annum on our in price for the next 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, to actually this thing could go back to growth. And that is, this is the bit where we've got slightly lucky or landed on our feet, is those same streamers that were sort of cannibalizing Pebble Beach's traditional broadcast market all of a sudden have started asking Pebble Beach for meetings to understand their software. And if you go on Pebble Beach's social media, they've got a LinkedIn and Twitter and that, all of a sudden there's a real flurry of, we've done this for this customer, or this trade expo, and so on. And that's because keener consumers of media on listening today will have noticed that Amazon Prime has started trying to do the Champions League and the Six Nations. There's talk of Netflix trying to get the Formula One. They're seeking to diversify away from series and high-cost productions by going into live entertainment. Now, live entertainment, it may be streamed, but it's still a linear broadcast. And therefore, there's this returning need for the market-leading expertise Pebble Beach has. And all of a sudden, you've now got, even after the sort of fairly dramatic share price move to the upside, I think from memory that it puts the business on 7x PE. Well, if you can get a 30, 35% growing EBITDA margin business growing at, say, 20% again, 7x PE is just wrong, even if you sensitize it for the small size of the business. And actually, it may be that someone just goes, well, at 15, 20, 25 million market cap, that's a really nice bolt-on. Thank you very much. We'll just take the IP for ourselves as part of a larger media services business. So there's plenty to go for here, albeit there's been a nice, healthy return for us. And another good example of our nursery portfolio sort of coming to its own, bit of dynamism, opportunistic. And really pleased with what they've done in the 6 months since we invested. They really listened. They've cut the spending on Prima. They're throwing off loads of cash. It led them to upgrade numbers. If you read the statement carefully, they can probably find more things to cut and save money on going forward. And as I say, there's then this cherry on top, which is some unexpected sales growth opportunity. So it's one we're watching quite closely, actually. We very rarely chase our winners, but this could be one at the right price where the facts have changed and changed with it, and we could even upweight.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think you've raised a really good, insightful point there, because given the significance now of YouTube TV, a lot of internet channels are lifting and shifting their broadcast onto YouTube TV and doing it through there, and therefore they need that sort of, like, as you say, that broadcast capability. And it's not your frontline, such as your Amazons and your Netflix, they're great examples, but it's more towards the second and third tier channels who are now going full bore straight onto YouTube TV and doing live broadcasts. So yeah, no, really, really, I hope they do. After 10 or 15 years of being sort of like off the radar, it's lovely to see a British company doing so well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, good. Okay, another one which has done really well and hitting the strides overseas. We've got a question from Tony asking about Alumask, which is the building products company. I think you mentioned last time they were doing these huge stormwater drains going into the Hong Kong
airport, etc. How do you see this one? It seems to have bucked the trend of a lot of building products businesses.
They have. In the office, it's always the share I'd buy from my nan is the way I summarize it. Really steady, sensible, grey-bearded management team. They know their industry and their brands inside out, and that's why they've been one of the very few construction-exposed businesses to keep hitting their forecasts. And probably in a parallel universe, with a more benign environment, they'd have been beating forecasts, I suspect, because they've absorbed things like national insurance rises without changing their numbers. They've absorbed the slowdown in house building without changing their numbers. It's just a really nice business that, again, yeah, is one of these gems amongst the rubble. We managed to buy it on 6x PE. It's on 10 now. Well, if they can get the margins from 13 to 15 plus, like they say, and this international growth comes through that I'm about to comment on, it's really a 15 times plus business. So we see 50% upside in the multiple. I think just a house building recovery sees a 20% upgrade to profits because they've been taking market share over the past 3 or 4 years in a falling market. Yeah, if that market then recovers, and yeah, if house building, say, goes from 150,000 homes, which is what I expect they'll do this year, sadly, the country, to nearer, I don't know, 200,000, still some way off the 300,000 required to hit the 1.5 million target. Well, that's a 33% increase in activity that Alumask on a flat market share basis would really benefit for. So it's well poised, this one. It's got brands, it's got pricing power from the specification that goes on for those brands. To remind listeners, this is where an architect will specify on runway 3 at Hong Kong Airport, you must use, in this case, it's a brand called Gatik Drains, Alumask and Gatik. So really, as long as they're not sort of profiteering and price gouging, they can sort of, they've got very good pricing power. The customer is told to use their drain. And a bit of an update on the international angle with that one, which is something we're excited about. So they've gone on to win another airfield. This time it was a NATO airfield.
Wow.
I think it was in Eastern Europe. 16,000 kilometers of slot drain.
Wow.
I actually got to see some of it being made when I was on a site visit a little while ago. They've won a couple of ports in South America, so Peru and Brazil. We've done some snooping of our own, as is the sort of work we like to pride ourselves on. Now, if it's architects specifying the drains, an obvious thing for me to do as part of my bedtime reading was look up whoever did the specification for Hong Kong Airport and see what other things they were working on. And we were quite excited to see that there's an airport renovation in Singapore going on by the same architect. And actually, that same architect is also working on King Salman Airport in Saudi Arabia. And I think, as is custom in the Middle East, keeping up with the Joneses, although I suspect that they use a different name over there. They're in Dubai, despite the fact they've already got, I think, the world's busiest airport. They're going to build another airport at the same time. And that, again, I think is using similar or the same contractors and architects. So these things aren't going to land tomorrow. But if you're a 5-year investor like us, these are really exciting things for a British company to be winning around the world. And because we like what these brands are doing, these products they design under those brands so much, we've really pushed Paul and the team to double down on R&D. Now, in this case, it means going from one person R&D to two in each division. But, these brands are real. If you go and talk to people in the industry like us, they won't have heard of Alumask offer, but they've definitely heard of Gatik, of Wade, of Harmer. Things like Slop Drain. And if they can monetize these further with new product designs, it can be quite meaningful. I mean, Tile Weep, which was a product in the Timlock stable. I didn't know what Tile Weep was 2 years ago, to be clear. One of the many joys of this job, you become slightly geeky about random things. A tile weep it goes into a rooftop with ventilation. And the guys designed Timlock, or the one guy at the time, there's now two of them, designed this 2 years ago. Well, last year they sold £1 million worth of these things at 25% EBIT margin. This is not insignificant stuff. And therefore, we're really encouraging them really to up the international sales team. they've done that, and you're seeing that come through in places like South America and the R&D. Now, the business came out with inline numbers very recently, very commendable. Almost every other construction exposed business is warning. But, you know, we feel for them. They're doing the right things. But if house building's at 2012 levels, there's only so much, only so many levers you can pull or tile weeps you can design to offset it. The stat that really stood out for us was the Timlock division, the one that makes these plastic weeps and vents for house building. They grew 9% in the year just gone, whereas the end market was down, according to the House Builders Federation, 20. So that's like 30%. In our industry, you call it alpha, wouldn't you? But yeah, 30% outperformance. Yeah, those sort of things don't happen by accident year in, year out.
Yeah. No, it's amazing how interested and animated you can get, isn't it, over storm drains and air vents, particularly when it's making you so much money. So I know exactly how you feel. Okay. Let's move to, we've got SE81. He's asking about a company in factory automation, high-speed packaging, MPAC. Did a couple of acquisitions the back end of last year, and then unfortunately has been hit by Liberation Day, the Trump trade tariffs, which has really hit the factory build sector out in the States. Just put a lot of deferred orders. When do you see the sort of like the situation normalizing for MPAC?
Yeah, that's been the big setback this year. If I'm honest, MPAC was a top pick for us starting in the year. We thought they could knock out a 12 or 30% operating margin versus broker forecasts of about 9.9. We thought that because what we felt that the synergies and acquisition assumptions were harsh. And as those were proven to be harsh, there would be upgrades. That clearly has not happened. The business has really suffered from a slowdown in CapEx decisions in the US. The European business is fine. But in the US, if you're a large consumer facing business, and you know, MPAC's lines cost $8, $9, $10 million to produce, it's a very obvious thing to just pause or delay when uncertainty spikes. And if I'm honest, that's always been a threat with MPAC. It has a slight history of this sort of thing. It's why we did trim our position earlier in the year and had done last year. Given we made a lot of money out of our in price of £1.80, we're still in the money on that investment, although some of the paper gains been lost near term. We're pushing the ball to look around corners a little bit more, be a bit more preemptive. We're very, very supportive of Adam, the chief exec, but almost because he's good, he's having to do a lot. And yet, listeners should look out for us kind of bolstering the ranks in the months and weeks to come. To answer the question directly, how do we see it evolving and hopefully recovering from here? I think it's two levers. You need to see a pickup in sort of capital activity, manufacturing PMIs in the US. That's something we're really hot on monitoring, because that will drive a throughput of work for MPAC. Really, for it's all about next year now. What happens next year? You know, this year isn't going to be a stellar year. Some harsh downgrades have gone through, so we'd like to think that's a one and done type mentality. The other thing they can do is rummage around behind the sofa, and you know, MPAC's balance sheet has a few interesting moving parts. Mm-hmm. The first is the pension, which is now in surplus and going through a buyout process. That has the potential to see them get back some of the escrow monies, £5 million or so, and obviously see that contributions cease to that scheme. So that's one potential sort of self-help type win. The other is in the sort of property estate of the business. Listeners will recall it used to be called Mullins or Molins. Alongside that, you know, rather glamorous pension scheme, which is now being bought out decades later, they also even had a Mullins sports ground, believe it or not. So the workers used to have a sports ground for running the sort of employee football team. That's not been used for many years now. I think it's held on the balance sheet at sort of notional value. But it's in the home counties. We're sort of pushing management to explore ways to monetize that better in a period of cash being particularly precious. In a world of 4 or 5% interest rates and banks. So there's things for management to do here. It's a good business. It's trading at a large discount now to transactions in the sector. So there's different levers we can pull here. It's got a strong, sensible shareholder base. Schroeder's at the top. You know, the likes of Briarwood, ourselves, Gresham House in there. So the board are well sort of supported, if not directed. And it's a recovery story now, having been quite an exciting growth one for us. So it's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I would certainly say that once the tariffs in the States have settled down and we get into that stage of the sort of the broad brush 15% or 10% import tariff going in into the US, then once those tariffs are settled down, you would think it would give confidence then to the pharmaceutical companies and the food and beverage businesses in the States to then, you know, basically sign that on the dotted line to actually do the planned factory automation and capex. So you could find it's stopped. It basically paused, but it hasn't finished because there's still a lot of it onshoring they need to do.
Correct. And some of the domestic, shall we call them, policies in the US are going to make sort of lower skilled labor harder than ever to source, and therefore impacts robotized automatic solutions are almost more important than ever.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move to retail. Not a sector that I'm particularly an expert in, but you've gone for Angling Direct, basically the UK's number one fishing tackle seller. And then I remember you've been, last couple of years, you've been talking about how it's sort of like branched out into Europe, but that's been a sort of bit of a hard slog. What's the latest view on Angling Direct?
In short, the latest is we've been bang on, correct. The shares have been a top performer for the portfolio. That asymmetric upside we'd identified for the listeners on the very first podcast as onward opportunities we did with you 2 odd years ago is borne out. I think we were buying at 25, 28 pence per share back then. They're now at 50. And this is because the UK business, which we're highly supportive of, the management team, which are really proving themselves to be equally as brilliant quality, have been delivering a number of sort of organic or self-help growth drivers have been in play. Really sensible stuff, like, you know, what I'm calling the Angler's Argos catalog that they call Shop the Range. So fishing tackle, there's tens of thousands of SKUs, and everyone's very particular about what they use. The historic challenge for the business has been, how do you monetize all those SKUs in small shops? Well, what's effectively a kind of glorified iPad in each store called Shop, with some very nice Shop the Range point of sale display around it, allows anglers to install just any SKU they want, come and collect it the next day by shopping the range if it's not in the shop. And it's proving a real hit. And you're seeing, you know, initiatives like that. The MyAD loyalty app, they've got that to 500,000 members in 2 years. That's driving real increases in consumer loyalty and ATV. And they're getting really good insights on customer behavior. I think the YouTube channel just had its 30 millionth view. They're doing all the right things to monetize this attractive demographic we spotted. I think when we first spoke, Paula, I said to you, we don't usually do retail, but if you're going to do it, it's selling to anglers who tend to be, you know, better off than most of the population. And they're a hobbyist for this sport. They love it. They spend more money than they should, and do it in a company where half the market cap is cash, which is still more or less the case, even after a 2-3 million quid buyback. And, you know, they've been opening 5 to 10 stores a year since we encouraged them to really go for it on that front. And we can see that continuing for a number of years now and really take their market share. It started at about 12.5. It's now at 15. They were targeting 20. We now think they can go north of 25 and really get, you know, some very strong market positioning powers that then are a really nice bat to take to the suppliers, where typically in retail it is where the money's being made at the moment. So a retailer like Angling Direct was making 30% gross margins. They've now got out to about 35%. We want to see it go to 37%. The tackle suppliers, these brands, Fox, Corder, Nash, etc., they're making 60% plus. Funnily enough, they're all private equity owned. So we see an opportunity. If you're increasingly important part of the UK value chain, you're going to have better pricing terms with the suppliers. Steve, to his credit, the chief executive, has started that dance, and sometimes it's been break dancing, sometimes it's been a bit of a boogie, but it's working. So hats off to him. And we see more tailwinds to come. I mean, just look outside the window. It's been a storming for Angling Direct summer in terms of weather conditions. They should benefit from what's going on in the dollar next year. So they tend to stock their inventory kind of now until Christmas for the following year's season, because a lot of it comes from the Far East. They buy in dollars, sell in pounds. So they haven't had that benefit yet, but should do next year if the current currency market moves maintain. The UK rollout will continue. And then really the European strategy decision now will have to come to a conclusion. It's just not got the unit economics that the UK business does. We see it as a total distraction now. We have done from the start. We've been patient. We've been respectful. And management have earned that patience and respect. They've been doing a really good job in the UK, but it just begs the question, why not do more of that and focus all your energy, drop all your nets in the lake that is the UK and keep catching fish like you have been there, and just move on from this European lake where they don't catch any fish, they lose money, they don't have a very good berth, they've got one shop, not 70 like they're in the UK. And actually, there's loads of other fishermen there that are way better and they've got better, bigger rods than them. And that is, you know, the European market is massive. That's why they've tried to crack it. It's just not happened. To me, if I'm totally honest, it smacks of a decision the previous board made when the shares were 90-odd p, even the business was half the size it is today and losing money, of, oh goodness, how do we justify 90p price and how do we get it? You know, how do we drive shareholder upside from here? Europe looks really big. Let's give that a go. They just don't need it now. The UK business is really good. There's some structural tailwinds coming their way. And as we've just said to shareholders before, one thing we came across in our diligence is, you know, there are acquirers of these fishing tackle retailers. Yeah, I think it was 2019 in the US, and then Svendon Sport was bought in 2022 in the Nordics. And if, you know, if Angling Direct gets up 25% market share, it could make a really nice part of a global angling portfolio, we think.
Yeah. In the last trading update, they delivered eye-popping 14% like-for-like sales returns, I think, or increases. Is that sustainable, sort of double-digit? I mean, it just seems so out of kilter with anything else on the sort of the retail high street.
It's why you want to... It's back to my point, Paul. It's why this demographic is attractive. They've actually probably been net beneficiaries of high interest rates rather than losers. So if you compare it to something like a war paint or something like that, you know, it's obvious why they would be having difficulties, and angling's been able to benefit. You know, but that growth is coming from a number of factors. You know, this shop the range tactic is really working. They are opening 5 or so stores per annum. That's a decent part of that organic growth story. And I think they're doing a little bit with pricing as well. That they talked about some capex to go to digital labeling in the stores this year. That will allow them to, I don't think they're going to be dynamically pricing the hooks, but it will allow them to very easily respond to opportunities to maximize margin on pricing and actually take out some headcount as well, because it's very time intensive because of all the SKUs changing the bloody pricing.
Yeah.
Labels. And so I think a 10% is probably more sustainable than 14%, but we do see this isn't X growth. This is a really nice, predictable business here that's just delivering. In a tough market, it makes you wonder what might happen in a better market.
Yeah, I know. Significantly outperforming the competition, no doubt about it. Okay, well, let's move sectors. We've got Mike. He's asking about advertising, media, consultancy, the Mission Group, which I think got a bid, didn't it, from Brave Bison earlier in the year. been always had a sort of checkered history. However, the debt does seem to be recurring, and it rejected the bid. How do you see this one?
So you had two bids last year, a material premium to where we invested at about 18 pence per share, and where the shares are today, which is about 21 pence per share or something. So I think it was 29p and 36 Brave Bison offered. That was a nice underpinning for us, but not really the end game. They've actually, you know, the more recent news is they've then, in early January this year, they disposed of about 15% of the profits for 70% of the market cap, i.e. they sold one of their divisions on, I think it was about 12 times. Significant premium to the 3 times the group is on at the moment. This is deep value territory here. I think shares haven't garnered much love for a few reasons. One, this is a UK-focused advertising agency, and whilst the business had some robust inline numbers at the half year, perception is perception, and I think people, you know, question how tough it must be out there. The other is this competition for capital points. So if you look at the start of 2025, the shares shot up from where they are today, more or less, to about 32 pence per share, and that was the transaction being announced. We were delighted. It was a cracking start to 25 for our portfolio. 50% gain on our investment. And they just drifted. There's been no bad news come out, but here we are back at, you know, there and back again. Investors are much more short-termist, we've noticed. They're also, I think, less liquid. So if there is a thing with good news and they can bank a profit with buyers in the market, they will, and they almost just want to move on to the next one quite quickly. And for us, that's almost as big a problem as the outflows, is this short-termist, you know. Even businesses can do good things and the shares that aren't, don't stay up for very long. So but what it does mean is you can now invest at the price we did however long ago, 18 months, but without the risk of them not doing some sort of disposal. And and they have. You've got a really interesting chief executive announced. I'm looking forward to seeing how he presents on things like Investor Meet Company or Vox Markets, because he's a bit of a maverick and a bit of a rock star from the dealings we've had with him just in these early days.
Is this John Carey? Is it John Carey?
Yeah. So we're quite excited about that and what he can do. Always like it when a non-media person comes in to run a media business. They tend to be a nice foil to the sort of creatives and division heads. So let's see where he takes it. But you know, we're there, we're happy holders, deep value at 3x EBITDA, 4x PE. One thing or the other will have to happen, because that is just a dislocation in price.
Yeah, okay, good. We've got SE81. He's asking about Light Science Technologies, which I've never, ever covered about, but I'm guessing it sort of like looks after sort of agribusinesses, help things grow. And I don't know what else it uses its light sciences. But first of all, what does it do and what's the investment thesis?
It does, but interestingly, we have absolutely no interest in the light or the science.
Oh, okay.
There's some hope, value, and upside there, but it's not why we've invested. And I'm about to explain why. So Light Science Technologies is actually three businesses under a group sort of umbrella. One is lighting for agri-tech and some other sort of sensors and data inputs. In fairness, sort of a bit more traction there than we might have hoped for, but it is very early days. It's doing about $1 million of turnover. Let's value it at $1 million, just for simplicity. Yeah. It's not going to move the needle in this calculation. You then got the contract electronics manufacturing business, which is really the legacy of the group. Does about, from memory, $8 million of sales, $500,000 of profit. Let's value that at $8 million. So 8 + 1 = 9. We then got the chance to invest at 2.1p in Light Science Technologies at about 9 million market cap, which is what 2.1 pence per share is, without therefore no value ascribed to the bit we are interested in, which I'm about to describe in a bit more detail. And this is injector fire barrier, the PFP division. So There is a well-documented problem in the UK with cladding. Anyone that's invested in a house builder will be familiar with the remediation provisions to basically make all these buildings safe. And there is the clock is running on this stuff, as are the checkbooks, because it's, if you think about it, very, very expensive to effectively remove all the old cladding on a building, do it in a safe way, because you've got people living in there, by the way, while you're doing this, and then put new cladding up, just at a time when actually a lot of these house builders are struggling, again, as we've just found out. What's really exciting about Injector Clad, or Injector Fire Barrier, who install Injector Clad, which is this graphite foam solution, which can be effectively, it can be installed with the existing cladding often remaining in place at a fraction of the cost of taking down the old cladding. And again, I'm clearly not a builder, so I'm going to simplify for effect. I have been on a site visit, and a keen follower of our Twitter or LinkedIn would have even seen me wearing one of the hard hats. So you can, this is definitely true. But yeah, if you go up, as I have done the site visit, they remove four clusters of bricks at each level on it with a cherry picker or some raised scaffolding. And this effectively graphite foam barrier is inserted in a mesh wrapping around each floor. And this foam expands exponentially if it detects a fire, the heat from a fire, and effectively fills every cavity. So the cladding is instantly safe. The installation of this work is very, very high gross margin. It's IP protected. Injector Clad is a patented product. It was formulated in 2019 after a house builder approached the Lewis family with, there's got to be a solution to this other than just ripping down the cladding, we can't afford it. It's really, really exciting if this takes off, and they have started to win some interesting contracts. It was really the Vinci one that caught our eye last year. Vinci is a blue chip, very large organization that trialed Injector Clad in one site. It seems to have gone very well. The exciting prospect is, can that lead to both Vinci going, well, could you do all of our other student accommodation? One, competitors, people like Watkin Jones, then seeing this and going, well, I fancy a bit of that. They've got a competitive advantage here when I see them write down their remediation provision, because they've done it this other way. And you know, the snag has been over the summer is the building safety regulator. So a lot of these projects we actually think are ready to go for LST and other businesses, and in a parallel universe of a sort of functioning practical bureaucracy sector would have probably even happened by now. Gateway 2 and Gateway 3 has log jammed. There's loads of work waiting to be signed off. What's interesting is that has been holding up all kinds of construction work, including, I think, some of these opportunities for LST. It's a 60% gross margin, so it can quite quickly have a transformational impact on the group profits and definitely be worth more than the nothing we paid for it. And some of the parts could even be worth 5-10 million in a year or two, depending on how quickly these contracts can be won. What's interesting, though, is the business, LST recently RNS'd this 50-year safety approval certification process for the Injector Clad product. And we think this might allow the business to lobby that their work doesn't actually require the building safety regulator sign off anymore, because it would no longer classify as a new build, but actually it's just an alteration to some existing infrastructure which goes through a different application process. If that is the case, it could unlock a nice little stream of work into Christmas and beyond. And you know, trackers of the stock will see we have been TL1ing in this recently, so we've actually added to this one quite recently, a higher than our original 2.1p entry price. Just, you know, very, very small business, but you know, very large addressable market. There's even talk of this Injector Clad product being approved and certified overseas, because the same problem exists in Europe and beyond. So quite a nice opportunity here we found to acquire some exposure to some IP with very high gross margins in a very large market with lots of work to go for. Some of these remediation provision budgets are hundreds of millions of pounds, and the market cap of LST is, well, it was 10, I think it's about 12 now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Taylor Wimpey's is about half a billion, I think, 450 or something. But just as a real-time example, I mean, you've got basically, if you turn your clock back to Grenfell, they had basically a flat fire, which then was a chip pan, and then caught onto the curtains, I believe, and then obviously then caught onto the external cladding on the building. How does that foam actually stop that occurring from, say, a fire from the inside?
So, yeah, I should probably do some sort of disclaimer here about fire safety and getting your own fire safety. but my understanding is that the danger with these cladding systems is you have the original brickwork, the sort of the structure of the apartment block, and then you have a cladding that makes it look nice.
Yes.
Which isn't sort of ugly bricks, breeze blocks. The problem are caused by this cavity, this almost air pocket between, is just pure fuel for flames to, once they've, in the example you've given, catch the curtains, then sort of lick up.
Yeah,
and it accelerates the spread of the fire very, very quickly. And that, as I understand it, was one of the big dangers with things, fires like Grenfell, is how quickly the fire can then spread up the building. And if this foam inflates and fills that air pocket, you know, air, oxygen is one of the three ingredients for flame. And therefore, it slows the spread of the fire, allowing time for both sprinkler systems to sort of manage and subdue, but then really for the fire brigade to get on site.
Right, okay. And then that, just on that building safety regulator, when do they actually approve a new house or a retrospective fitting to be able to then to make it inhabitable? Is it basically once, say, the retrofit has happened, or when the building's made, or is it done on the architect's plans? Because where's this congestion happening? Is it that final step of it to, as you normally get a sort of like a building regulator coming in to sign your house off?
Yeah, this is gateway 2 and 3 rather than gateway 1. So it's like, is that slightly more progressed example?
Yeah.
The painful thing is that the work is there, not just for things like science do, but other construction products, which, you know, we desperately need in this country at the moment, you know, economic activity, the growth, it's there, a bit like the planning regulation. The issue is not the willingness or the work, it's the red ink to, you know, or the ribbon cutting, annoyingly.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Yeah, I can understand why that is such a pain for the whole process. If it's just like a huge logjam congestion and that whole getting completed buildings up to be sellable state. Okay, let's move to a final one. We got carpet and flooring distributor Likewise in a really, really, really tough market. I cannot believe how well the shares have performed. They've obviously got some sort of like magic wand there, which is doing well, because Headlam's, a competitor of them, has gone the other way totally.
Well, that's actually the thesis here, Paul, interestingly. Right. So in Tony Brewer, we've kind of got the sort of the Alan Shearer of carpets. Best-in-class management team, really. And that is why the business, a bit like Alan Mask in some ways, but in this case, it's more the management team, I think, doing the heavy lifting than brands. Yeah, they are making headway in a really tough market. Again, outperforming end markets that are going backwards, growing sales, growing profits now, and that's really the key part for us. So what we think we've got here is so Tony Brewer, who I mentioned a moment ago, he actually ran Headlam for worked there for 25 years, ran it for 15-20, and if you pulled up a share price chart of Headlam over the past 20-30 years, you'll see, if you overlay where he became chief executive in the late 90s, the shares went on to go from 50p to 5 quid between 2000 and 2008. You then had the GFC, they came back to 60p, and he took them back to £6 again. So he sort of did a 10x twice for shareholders. I think the shares, he then left in 2016. The shares peaked not long after, and they've been a sorry state of affairs ever since. I don't think Tony will mind me saying he was quite aggrieved to have left the business he helped build to such a dominant force. I think it was as much as half a billion market cap when he left. It's now 50.
Yeah.
I think that's almost where the name Likewise comes from for Likewise, because he set out Likewise to go again and show, I think you're on a bit of a vendetta. Yeah. Sometimes wary of stories like that. But what's interesting with Likewise is he's delivering now in the numbers. So the business has gone from loss-making and heavy capital investment to profitable and much reduced CapEx requirements. They've probably got 3/4 of the depots they need now. That's all that money's been spent. It's mainly freehold property. They've got the trucks in place. A couple of little nuggets that stood out to us early on as we were getting to know Tony, and this is when we put the shares originally in the nursery at sort of 14p down at the bottom of that chart you've go on the screen there. 52 people had left Headlam willingly to go and work with him at Likewise. Now, yeah, a lot of those were salespeople, and we all, you know, salespeople driven by their wallet. So we had people here leaving the established dominant player to go and get the band back together with Tony and really voting with their wallets and their paychecks. So that really caught our attention. We noticed that the business was going from loss making to sort of forecast 4 million of profits for the year we're in now. That felt like a bit of a game changer for us as long-term investors. And then more recently, and this is why we've doubled our investment in Likewise at 25p to 8% of our fund, is we've now overlaid the difficulties going on at Headlam and actually Victoria as well. And it creates a bit of an asymmetric bet.
Yeah.
And Likewise, a bit like how Angling Direct was for us at 28p, which I think even you said a couple of years ago, don't quite get this one, Laurie. It looks optically expensive. And you could say the same about Likewise on a snapshot today. But what we think, one or two things happens from here for Likewise that, you know, both dramatically increase its prospects for profits and growth. What we think could happen is life remains tough for longer in this end market of installing flooring. It's a geared play on housing transactions, which you discussed has been tough, and the consumer isn't spending loads of money at the moment. Well, Likewise is showing they can grow and make money in that environment, so they can be a survivor. But actually, Headlam is now massively geared, as is Victoria. And, you know, balance sheets can buy you time, but they can't bail you out. They ultimately catch up with you. So there's a scenario where Headlam and maybe Victoria hit difficulties and create openings for Likewise to go for, therefore increasing their sales. The other alternative is the market does quite dramatically improve. That drives a great, you know, increase in activities for Likewise, and you see profit upgrades and profit growth. And he ends up looking like, you know, Tony and the team have got their timing bang on. But either way, there's a really nice 3 to 5 year story here. But we are backing the man. You know, this is not, on a multiple basis, doesn't look deep value on a PE basis. It does on a NAV basis, but not on a PE basis. We're backing Tony here to bring it through and have the operational gearing drop through. And, yeah, we like what we found here. And to your point earlier about catalysts and idiosyncrasy, well, if Tony's going to take market share, he's going to take market share. Interestingly, I think 2 weeks ago was the first time Likewise's market cap was greater than Headlam's. So who knows how long that trend could continue. Yeah. But one extreme is to go all the way to the size of Headlam, which was 500 million once upon a time and would be multiples higher than we are today.
Yeah. No, you raise a really good point on that competitive side, certainly, because if either Victoria, who have definitely got a really stretched balance sheet, and Headlam do actually have an event whereby they bring in the insolvency, if that ever happened, then you had a similar movie play out in the office fit out system with Morgan Sindall, and their biggest competitor ISG went bust about 18 months ago, and Morgan Sindall's shares have never looked back since. They've just gone through the roof.
Look, I mean, that's one extreme scenario. What you might get is a kind of middle scenario where, because Headlam's losing money and got massive interest bills, they can't spend the same money Likewise can on marketing and sales, and they just lose that way. But it is an interesting dynamic to watch play out from here, for sure.
Yeah, optionality. Okay, brilliant. Well, we've come to the end of the interview. But before I sort of finish, I always ask my experts, what's your favourite sort of like stock or the one you'd sort of like highlight to investors over the next sort of 12 months to stick on your watch list?
I think at the microcap end, you know, if Light Science really can convert some of the contract momentum they claim to have in their half year results, that they pretty openly talk about it in the CEO's report, then that has the potential to move quite quickly as a small company with big potential. Mm. I think then at the other end of the spectrum, you know, we very recently made Audio Boom our largest holding.
Yeah.
It's one we've traded around in the past in the nursery, but what we think we've spotted here now is the podcast market is really coming their way, and that is coinciding with Audio Boom's profit drop through really starting to happen. And the nuts and bolts of what's going on is, for decades, advertisers have relied on TV production and print media to find the people to advertise to. And again, I'm going to simplify this for effect again, for my benefit as much as everyone else's. What's going on in podcasting that's really quite exciting is, for the fraction of a cost, i.e., you know, you and I on a call like this today and a couple of microphones, yeah, we can garner an hour of people's time. Sadly, not that many in our case, but if you're, I don't know, doing Gary Lineker's football podcast, you tend to get quite a few listeners. If you can capture those earlobes and eyeballs for an hour at a fraction of the cost of, say, I don't know, producing an episode of Downton Abbey or something, well, you've got a massive advantage then when you deal with advertisers, because you can get them those eyeballs and earballs at a much lower cost and still make a far higher profit margin. And it's why I think some of these TV production companies are struggling at the same time the podcasters are booming. It's a better mousetrap, a better set of unit economics for advertisers to get to the consumer. And actually, some of the evidence is the conversion and the ROI is much higher even at that lower cost. So this is one where it feels like the market's coming their way. It's had a slightly checkered past, but has sorted out a lot of the issues. It is increasingly profitable now. It is growing. The profits will now finally start to convert to cash because the last of the onerous contracts ends at Christmas. And, you know, we can see this getting to sort of 100 million of sales, 10 million of EBITDA with just some fairly simple contribution margin analysis, even within the next 18 months. So ahead of where it's forecast to be at the moment. But if you extrapolate forward what the podcast market is doing and what Audio Boom's been doing, it's pretty exciting. And we're going to a key period now for these businesses where the NFL season, Thanksgiving, Christmas shopping is a real inflection point for advertising spend. So it's all eyes on how they can deliver. H2 is a big half for them. Yeah. We hope it's going to be a good one.
And just in terms of that ROI, how does it compare to sort of like, I don't know, Instagram, Facebook's, or you look at YouTube, or alternatively, you know, search in for Google? I could understand why podcast ROI is better than linear telly, because that's pretty much awful. It's at the bottom of the tree, or newspapers. But is it actually better than the sort of the best of the best, which has always been held up as Facebook and YouTube?
It's definitely, this is a bit of a cascade. So the direct sort of recommendations you can get from like a podcaster talking about how they love a supplement or a product they've used, that directly competes with, if not outperforms, the kind of Instagram type, YouTube type placement. It's quite a similar sort of dynamic between consumer and sort of trusted face talking about it. To your YouTube point, yeah, there's quite an interesting RNS from Audio Boom very recently. They're sort of visualizing a lot of these podcasts pretty rapidly, so they are YouTube content themselves, and that's clearly proving to be quite successful with them based on what was disclosed in the RNS. And advertisers are identifying this as a real way to get people's sort of undiverted attention and convert. And you're seeing it in some of the, I think that they term it RPM, which is sort of revenue per 1,000 users. Advertisers are paying up increasingly to people like Audio Boom because it is working and the ROI is there. And the cash they're throwing off now, they're starting to use for little bolt-ons. We saw that a couple of months ago. So that can get quite interesting as well. So let's see what the run into Christmas brings.
Okay. And what's the sort of the revenue model with the likes of their big distributors? Because obviously they must push it through iTunes, Apple, effectively Apple Podcasts, and they must put it through Spotify, which together, or iHeartRadio, whatever it is, the big boys must account for 80-90% of all of their listens. So what's the sort of the revenue share model there? And what is there any dependence on a couple of customers there?
So you're right. It's about 20 to 30% is the typical spread Audio Boom receives net of the various splits with the platforms and obviously the content producers.
Yeah, okay.
You get the sort of lion's share. But as you're seeing from the sort of drop through coming now on Audio Boom's trading updates, there's plenty of profit to go around. I think Audio Boom has 15 employees. And it doesn't need to go up very much from here. So the operational gearing can get quite massive now. We're breaking out beyond that point. And if you look at it on a kind of net revenue basis, that the margins are really quite revealing. And we're looking forward to seeing more of that.
Good. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks a lot, Laurie. Absolutely fascinating. As always, big congrats again on the excellent returns. Over the 12 months and 2.5 years since you've started it. And I know your target, I think, is to get the market cap even higher than it currently laughs. So thanks very much again, Laurie, and look forward in touching base in 6 months' time.
Thank you, Paul. And obviously, quite a few names I didn't get a chance to talk about today. We cover loads in our report and accounts that were out this morning. So if people want to have a read, they can go there. And I'm sure I'll be back on hopefully soon to do the rest.
Good.
So thanks, everyone, and thanks for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.